Are you prepped for it? Because I am not.
Get yourself good and drunk, bake a cake, and listen to the Uncut Gems podcast, a weekly show where we talk about movies that no one else wants to talk about. This is episode 138, and my name is Randy.
And my name is Jakob.
All right, so it's just us today, and of course, all of you out there listening, so thank you very much for joining us. Before we get into the day's proceedings, we'll quickly whip out the bulletins, go through our announcements, and go through our Patreon plugs. Head on over to our Patreon, which is at patreon.com/uncutgemspod, where we discuss cinema's better known films. And for just $3 a month, $4.50 Canadian, you can get access to, I think we're up to around 65 recordings now. So you can listen to all kinds of stuff on there. We have a full David Lynch marathon. We have mini retrospectives that tie in on a monthly basis, once a month to what we're doing on the main show. And in 2023, we've got two projects that are ongoing on Patreon. So we've got our John Cassavetes marathon. So a recent episode was just launched where we talked about the killing of a Chinese bookie. Go check that out. And later this month, watch for an episode, the next episode in that series. And we're going to be talking about John Cassavetes' opening night. So those are there. Check out our Patreon and see those. And we're also going through a project where here on the main show, we're covering Steven Soderbergh's lesser known films. But on Patreon, we are talking about his better known films. So I think it was just a little over a week ago, we released our conversation to our Patreon where we talked about Side Effects. Meanwhile, as a tie-in to what we're doing here on the main show, and this month our theme is our Arnold Schwarzenegger's 80s action films, all of which didn't do that well at the box office, by the way.
And they start with a letter R.
And they start with the letter R, hence the R Arnold. But our tie-in is a conversation, great conversation, actually, because we just wrapped that chat, on Conan the Barbarian. So at the time of this episode being released, I believe Conan the Barbarian will have just come out. So check that out. And if you want a good sample of our work on Patreon, you can check out our January 2022 episode where we talked about 30 years of Reservoir Dogs. So we talked about 90s films inspired by Quentin Tarantino and Reservoir Dogs. We talked about Go, Boondock Saints, Way of the Gun. In May of this year, we talked about Heat. And last year, we also talked about John Carpenter's The Thing. That was a June 2022 episode. So these episodes are out there, free, unlocked, forever. Go check them out, www.patreon.com/uncutgemspod. Or if you'd like to support us another way, you can leave us a one-time donation at ko-fi.com/uncutgemspod. That's ko-fi.com. Or you could just leave us a star rating or a review wherever you get your podcasts. Such an act would be very much appreciated. Or you can just tell your movie-loving friends about us, or you can reach out and connect with us. You can reach us through our socials, on our website, www.uncutgemspodcast.com, or via our email, uncutgemspod@gmail.com. Or, you know what, if all that's too much work, just keep listening, because we love having you there. So thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Now, task at hand. As I mentioned, this month's theme, RR Arnold. So this is Arnold Schwarzenegger's 80s action bombs, all of which start with the letter R. Last week, we talked about the very reddest of warrior princesses, Red Sonja. But today, without any further ado, let's get talking about this week's RR Arnold action buffet, Raw Deal.
What are we having for dinner?
Just this.
This is gonna make us fat.
You think because we're in shape, we're not already fat? We're like all the cows they raise around here. Stuck. Victims of circumstance. And you know what a cow's biggest contribution to this world is?
should not drink and bake.
All righty. So Raw Deal, 1986 film, was directed by John Irvin. It was written by Gary DeVore, who also wrote Running Scared, Showdown in Little Tokyo, Passenger 57. So he's a gentleman who wrote within this genre quite a bit. And Norman Wexler, who he's the other screenwriting credit here. He wrote Serpico, Saturday Night Fever, Drum Joe. So he was a very active writer with all kinds of interesting projects in the 70s and early 80s. The film stars Arnold Schwarzenegger, Catherine Harrell, Darren McGavin, Sam Wanamaker, Ed Lauder, Robert Davey, a few other people. And yeah, Raw Deal tells the story of Arnold, who is a disgraced former FBI agent. Although I guess he's not really disgraced. He was given a raw deal. But anyway, as the film starts, he's working as a sheriff in a small town in North Carolina, I think it is, until one day he's given a chance to redeem himself in the eyes of the FBI. So an old FBI buddy contacts him. This is Darren McGavin, who is the dad in A Christmas Story. So I know this guy fairly well from this particular film.
He's also a dad in here.
And he's a dad in here, too.
Also a father.
Yes. Thank you. So Arnold has to work undercover to infiltrate a Chicago mob organization. So Arnold has to go on the down low, and he has to take down the Chicago mob organization. And if he does this, then he can possibly get back into the FBI and possibly win back the affection of his wife. So more or less, that's Raw Deal.
His wife was given a raw deal. Like, look at that.
Oh yeah, we'll be getting into that.
She was not consulted about any of this.
No, she had very little say. But you know, in fairness, she may have been drunk and passed out and slept through the opportunity to discuss it. But we'll be talking about.
You should not drink and bake.
Exactly. We'll talk about her momentarily. Schwarzenegger apparently didn't really want to do this role initially. He was, from my understanding, under contract with De Laurentiis, who's the producer of this. He had one more film, I think it was, maybe two, to do for De Laurentiis. Arnold really wanted to do Total Recall, actually, at the time, which was a property of De Laurentiis. And De Laurentiis was working on developing that, but he said to Arnold playing that, no way, because we don't want that. Besides, Patrick Swayze has already been cast, so forget it. So actually,
imagine that.
There you go. Yeah, because Total Recall was a bit of a coveted project, I guess, and De Laurentiis really wanted to do it. And Raw Deal was seen as a way to make a quick buck in the action market, the evolving action market of the 1980s. So Raw Deal was meant to make some money to make Total Recall. So we'll get into why that didn't happen, I guess, momentarily. But according to Schwarzenegger, when Raw Deal didn't make that much money at the box office, it was the nail in the coffin for Total Recall. So there you go. It was my next note. So De Laurentiis couldn't afford it anymore, so sold Total Recall off to Carolco. So that got booted ahead down the production line in the care of a different production company. As for Raw Deal, Schwarzenegger apparently enjoyed the shoot. He really liked working with John Irvin, who he found to be a really good actor's director, and he felt he learned his craft of acting on Raw Deal. He got a lot out of it and learned a lot because, keep in mind, he's early in his career here. He's still learning how to become an actor, and he found this was a very important film for that growth.
Some would say he's never learned.
some might, but
we're
anyway.
We're not those people, are we?
Well,
no, sorry, Bob.
We'll get to it.
Actors are very sensitive.
Yes, are they now? Well, so just another comment or two on the De Laurentiis side of the ledger here, because there's not a whole lot of info I came across on the backstory of Raw Deal, but Raw Deal was the first film that was released under DEG. So that was De Laurentiis Entertainment Group. So this was one of De Laurentiis companies that was trying to behave a little bit like a studio and a distribution company as well. So it was only around for 5 years. And from what I can tell, the business model was to create action films or films that would have a good catch, make money in the American market, and then take the profit to sort of finance the next run of films. That just sort of seemed to be the business model for this. So make films on $10 million budgets or less, and then try to do well off those and repeat. Like it's almost a little bit like what the Blumhouse model turned into, only wasn't nearly as successful. And Canon Films was doing the same type of thing in the 80s. So, and anyway, DEG had lots of quality films, but none really had too much of a memorable box office. So maybe that's why it didn't last very, very long, because it was defunct in 89, as I said. Okay, Raw Deal did open in 1986. It made only $16 million in the US, so there are no worldwide figures available, because another piece of the business model seemed to be to get pre-sales from foreign distribution companies, so that whenever the film was released in the US, DEG would make the money off the US release, and then the pre-sales were for international companies to sell it and distribute it. So those presumably were smaller independent distributors who had no obligation to report financial figures. So I don't know how much money Raw Deal made abroad, because it didn't make a dime for DEG, because those pre-sales basically went into the budget and gave them financing to make the movie to begin with. Upon release, critics mostly hated it. Some disliked it for its level of violence. Some disliked it because it was stupid.
Stupid.
Pauline Kael, she said, it's reprehensible, but enjoyable. So it makes you feel brain dead after 2 minutes, but then you can have some fun with it. Ebert gave it 1.5 stars.
Oh, he said, stupid.
he was in that camp. This is stupid. With a plot so simple, it's hard to believe that Raw Deal managed to mess it up. That's from Ebert.
No shit.
That's what he said. That's what he said, Ernie. And Paul Attanasio, who I like to mention just because he's the creator of one of the best TV series of all time, Homicide: Life in the Streets, he was a Washington Post critic in the 80s. And he said that Raw Deal is a mostly tedious, cheaply made shoot 'em up that recycles the cliches that have long been cut, the cud of television cop dramas. So he was more or less unimpressed.
And you know, by the way, yep. Just saying, whenever we come up with Uncut Gems Bingo, Randy mentions Homicide: Life on the Street as the best TV show ever made, has to be an item on the list.
Should be. It should be.
I just had to say.
I know. I wish it were a palatable size that we could actually, you know, do a year-long thing talking about it, but it's 100 and some episodes, so it's just not feasible, but great show.
TV Uncut Gems podcast. Whenever I lose my job and I don't have anything else to do, then maybe.
There you go. Perfect. So anyway, audiences also, back to Raw Deal, they were more or less met on it. But that brings us to us. It's our turn to investigate. Jakob, are you with the critics who didn't like it? Or did you find that Pauline Kael was correct in her assessment that there's some value in here once you sort of leave your brain at the door? Where were you with Raw Deal?
You know what? This, again, one of those movies that I remember seeing when I was very young. It's kind of like Red Sonja. I watched it and moved on immediately. So I think I just watched it only once when I was, you know, too young to be watching it. I think that's probably the way to put it. So I probably didn't understand too much of it now. So I rewatched it now. It was kind of like I've never seen it. And you know what? I think I want to say they're both wrong, because it's a fun film. It's fun, but it's also cliche, But then again, I'm just watching this. I'm like, what's wrong with cliche exactly? Like, why is this a problem, right? Because I don't necessarily think this movie is trying to do anything special. It's not trying to have a conversation with the viewer on some kind of a thematic level. It's a gangster's. It's essentially the Departed of its time. Like, it's kind of like,
oh Jesus.
Oh, this is going
are you okay?
This is The Departed of its time. No, it's the genre of
pre-Infernal Affairs.
Yeah, it's it's just the idea of this sort of the like we've watched a bunch of like Hong Kong films where
this is a
staple of. There's this guy, a disgraced police officer, maybe not disgraced, maybe just down on his luck, and he has this assignment. He has to go undercover and he has to infiltrate this place, and then he has to find whoever's doing whatever his financiers want him to stop, right? That's kind of the gist of it. So you don't necessarily have to care about who's who and then why, whether this has to be an Italian mob or not. By the way, this movie on the Blu-ray I have starts with a black card, so like in disclaimer of beware, this movie reflects stereotypes that modern audiences may find hurtful. I'm just saying, like, okay. Really? Like, okay. Maybe I'm just too old to understand certain things, but is this just about the depiction of the Italians as the mobsters, or is it about depiction of women? Not too many. Is it the cake? I don't know.
It's about the stereotypical representation of men. Men are more. Multifaceted than this.
But I'll say this just to kind of cut a long story short and just leave you with my initial impressions. Two things I'll say just in general terms. One, I actually enjoyed the film as a sort of this gangster sort of, you can't call it a police procedural because it's like it's like calling Invasion USA a police procedural.
Agreed, so, yeah.
It's kind of like a canon film, but without the canon sort of backing, right? So yep. you can't take it seriously. It's kind of like a Hong Kong film, Italian film. That's that kind of genre of non-Hollywood film made in America that if it wasn't for Arnie, maybe 5 years later, this is where Brandon Lee takes the top billing in his, like before he gets to be in Showdown in Little Tokyo and Rapid Fire. Is this one of those jobs? So I really appreciate it on that front because it's just a fun, engaging sort of this totally disposable genre film, and also one of the few examples, and maybe one of the few last examples, because there are a few more, like we talked about Conan, where this is also a feature where Arnold Schwarzenegger as a character is not playful at all, and I actually found this like academically very stimulating, and I'm hoping we dig into it a little bit more, but I really enjoy this film.
Cool.
Over.
All right. So, yes, I saw this last year, and I'm going to say that was the first time. I don't remember seeing this before, so I watched it again this week. And I'm glad you mentioned the Hong Kong thing. That's something I thought whenever I was watching this. I didn't make a note to that effect, but thank you for reminding me of that. And I think I'm with you.
You're welcome.
100% on this is that stupid isn't quite fair. Sure, that's fine. You can call it a stupid film, whatever. The label doesn't matter too much, but I think it's not really truly stupid. I think that this is a film whose goals are really the lowest hanging fruit. It doesn't aspire to do too much.
It's a film with a bar set nice and low.
Exactly. It's exactly that. So, you know, that's fine. You know, so it's really hard for a film like Raw Deal at the end of the day to be a four and a half, 5-star film, just because its aims are so modest. But within that, I think it does its job fine. It's easier to take, you know, this film with the lowest hanging fruit. If you miss that objective, if you miss the goal of what you're doing here, then it becomes a true disaster. And it isn't that. Like, it's all kinds of different things. Like, it's not great, but it does a perfectly fine job. In, you know, just sort of this limited emerging 80s action film. And you mentioned canon. I think you're bang on there as well, because that's what this whole business model for DEG seemed to be. Let's make a quick buck on this. So, you know, films are making money on video. Films are making money here. If we have a very small budget, this should be an easy $20 million at the box office. Like, I think there's this type of mindset that's going into it. So I think that's very similar to the way Canon was going about their business with, you know, pay for it with pre-sales and then, you know, try to make your money off the box office in the States, because maybe your pre-sales came from international distribution. And then
cross your fingers for home video sales.
Yeah, exactly. And then the money that you take in off of that, that feeds your next one. And one of these is going to be a real gold mine. I think that's the idea here. So I think Canon is a very good take. So I had a lot of the very, very similar thoughts. I think that's interesting. Yeah, we'll talk about Arnold here. I find Arnold is interesting here because it's the first, this and Commando, and
same year, by the way.
I was going to say, right?
Commando
was the year before, but certainly the same little window of time. Arnold is a character who's a normal dude because, you know, before this he was, you know, a gladiator type in the Conans and Red Sonja, and he was the Terminator. So this seems to be, now that he's a star, let's trust him with what do those Burt Reynolds films look like from the 70s? What if we put Arnold in one of those or Stallone in one of those? This is the new emerging male form action hero. So let's put Arnold in what in the 70s would probably have been a Burt Reynolds film. So anyway, those are my initial response. I think it's perfectly fine.
This is Steve McQueen written all over it.
Or McQueen, yep. Yeah, but those guys, right? Like,
Charlie Bronson.
Yeah, he's another one. So, like, I watched a few Burt Reynolds films, so I guess he's in mind.
George C. Scott.
Not so much him, because the George C. Scott characters, they have some sort of reigning emotion that Scott has to embody.
I know. William Devane.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Rolling Thunder guy.
This is a Rolling Thunder type of thing.
Or yeah. Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah. But, yeah, at any rate, someone in the 80s said, let's put Stallone in Cobra. Let's put Arnold in Raw Deal. Because this super built macho athletic guy, this is sort of the new thing that people are responding to in the marketplace. So let's put him in a cop film or a mob film or whatever. And that's what we get here. So yeah, I enjoyed, you know, for what it is. So in terms of jumping into this, what is your take on how we end up here with Arnold in this low budget piece? Where do you think he is in his career in terms of, is he picking his projects? Like, what does he have a say in what he's doing? Just behind the scenes, what is your take on how we end up here? And I think we've already sort of hit on it a little bit, but is there anything to add?
I think you did kind of just explain it a little bit better than I ever would, where I think he just, this was a contractual obligation for him, right? I don't know how he picked projects. I would expect, because Commando, massive success, Terminator, Conan, another Conan. Okay, Red Sonja was a bit of a flop, right? But then, so he has a box office draw, right? And then maybe he gets to pick his projects, and maybe this is one that he goes like, well, I just have to do one more so I can do Total Recall, so I can get out of this contract that I'm in. And he just picks that. But then again, something in my mind wants to say that maybe the reason he picks this is also because it's a new challenge. Because well, first of all, like, I don't want to say I immediately disagree with what you just said, but I kind of do. Like, well, Commando is not a film about a regular human being. He's a superhero who also happens to be a dad. He's kind of like John Wick, right? In a way, they take his daughter and he goes into revenge mode. He goes into the sort of action mode, and, you know, like, to the tune that he still leaves with one-liners, and he's just like, did you leave anything for us? Just bodies, you know? So he's a one-man army, right? And here, this will be the first instance where he's a guy. He's just a guy. He could be, you know, like Matt Damon, you know, just a dude. Which I think there is a challenge for him, because there's a lot of line reading, a lot of his role is full of dialogue, And also, he has to be a regular guy. I don't want to say a prototype John McClane, because I think he's not... I don't want to suggest that, oh, this is like a proto diehard. No, no, no. But then the idea of a character of, here's this guy who's like an ordinary guy in an extraordinary situation. I think this may be an appeal because it's new to him. I feel that's kind of where I'm at with it. I would probably say that maybe he, if he picks this project, this would be the challenge, because he's a guy who doesn't want to rest on his laurels ever. He's not doing anything because it's comfortable. He wants to push himself. So I think that's it.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I think you're hitting on something here. So, because I have a note here. This is Arnie in a suit, which we haven't seen before. And I think Schwarzenegger himself even said that, I like doing this movie because I actually had a number of costume changes, which were interesting because, you know, previously he either had the biker jacket or he had loincloths and, you know, bison skin or whatever the heck he's wearing in Conan, right? So how do you think he does here if we sort of get into this? Because I'm with you. I think that just on a personal level, Arnold has these traits that are really admirable. And now he's involved with this career. He's going to give it his all, and he's going to, you know, take voice lessons, take acting lessons. And this is a challenge to him. And I think that he's going to, you know, work really hard at it. I just think that's the kind of dude that he is. So, does he work? Like, 'cause he's this giant of a man with, like we've said it a number of times, and he's got this accent where the words sort of fumble around in his mouth and sort of roll out awkwardly. But does he work? Does he pull it off?
I think so. I think it's fun to see, because, like, bear in mind, you have to filter this through the fact that I really love the guy. So, you know, there's that. So, like, don't take me seriously, right? But I think he does really well for what he... Remember, this is him early on in his career. So his range is what it is. His charisma is what it is, right? And then his sort of the self-aware performance has to be tucked away for this role. So he doesn't get to be, you know, doesn't get to be like Joe Santo in Stay Hungry. He doesn't get to be like John Matrix in Commando. He doesn't get to be self-aware even a little bit. He has to be super serious. So he has to hide inside a character. And how do you hide a guy who's probably like 110 kilos of pure protein, pure muscle, right? How do you put him in a suit that he looks convincing, right? So obviously he doesn't look, like, he looks a little bit out of place. You kind of always have to, like, you watch this film, you know, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger in a suit. Like, only later he gets to get away with it a little bit better. Like, in True Lies, he gets away with it a little bit better, right?
So it would be interesting to see this in theaters in the 80s or on video in the 80s when you're accustomed to Arnold being this fantasy guy, this sci-fi guy. He's the Terminator. He's Conan. And as you said, even Commando a little bit, like, he's a one-man army. He's sort of hyper stylized and super real, and he's bigger than life in a way there. So this is the film, one could say, that sort of normalizes him, because I watch this now, I think nothing of it because of, you know, True Lies, and, you know, I follow the guy on Facebook, and I see him as sort of this unique dude, but he's, in a way, he's just a dude. So over the years and sort of growing up with him to a point, he has humanized. He's not just this incredible Hulk type of figure. He is a guy. He's a guy that, like, a smart guy that ran a state with the economy the size of Canada. Like, this is a guy with a resume, but is also very personable. So when the film opens and I see him driving the Jeep, I see sort of all the Arnolds that I know, but it would have been really interesting to see this in 1982 when you only know him as the Terminator, or you only know him as Commando or Conan, because this is a film, I think, that was that? What?
You said 82. 82 was Conan. I think it's just... No, it's
oh, mistake. Sorry, 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 sorry. Yes. So if you're watching this, yes, thank you. Yeah. So if you're watching this in 86 and you just know, oh, this is the guy whose movies are doing gangbusters on video, but I only know him from wearing, you know, the big shaggy boots and having the sword, or, you know, having a robot exoskeleton underneath. this is sort of a weird adjustment to see him in like the flannel shirt driving a Jeep in the opening scene.
Mm-hmm. There's one thing. See, this is something that's a useful conversation. Would be an interesting conversation if you swapped him for Stallone, right? Because I think Stallone would have much easier time embodying that kind of like an everyman character, or just like an ordinary guy in an extraordinary sort of circumstance. Even though he's still built very well, he's very athletic, and he takes care of his body. Not to the same tune as Arnold, because he's just twice as big, especially that I think Stallone is like 4'7" or something like this. I don't know. He's very small.
5'8" or something, yeah. 4'7".
Just a few inches fewer, and he would qualify for some kind of government assistance.
Yeah, he
would get the front seat in the bus. Yeah. Okay.
Peter Dinklage. Peter Dinklage gets the roles that Sly doesn't.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Sorry. Carry on.
Because Stallone is very tiny. What I'm trying to say is that, you know, it would be interesting to see him because like Stallone has this a very naturalistic swagger about him. He can be Rocky Balboa, just bullshit you around, and he just behaves like he's just cool. Meanwhile, Schwarzenegger always has to translate everything that he thinks from German to English, right? Because it's still very early in the game for him. So I take it with a pinch of salt and just say, like, look, he's really trying. He's really trying, and he's really kind of like, for what his range is at the time, he's really doing well. And it doesn't help that he doesn't know how to walk either. Did you notice? This is one of those things that Schwarzenegger does. It. He doesn't really move his hands as he walks, so he kind of looks like this sort of hulking figure who just has his arms by his side just walks like this oak with
legs. This is hilarious. I forget where I read this because I watched both Conan movies this week, and I watched this, and so I was reading notes here, there, and everywhere online about these films. So it might have been this film, but Arnold apparently had to practice, I'm going to say for hours maybe, to practice moving his arms when he walks extemporaneously, I think is the word, which means you're doing it so that you're not even thinking about it. Like he had to practice it thinking about it, but he had to like keep doing it and doing it and doing it, moving his arms while he walks.
Because he looks like he's thinking about it, right? So he looks kind of like a tin soldier, on like a wind-up toy sometimes, you know?
Yeah.
Just...
looks agree. It must ridiculous. Have been with this film.
So it doesn't Stallone, help when he's... But when you sorry, put him ahead. In a suit, it doesn't help where he kind of just has this sort of very robotic demeanor, right? That he put him in a suit, and the suit has to be like three sizes too big because no one maybe had the time or the inclination to actually tailor the suits to him, so they kind of look a little bit baggy. Mm-hmm. To me, like when he has this hair slicked back and he's sitting down in a casino, he's kind of like he actually pulls it off. Like he's like, I don't want to say almost like Daniel Craig in Casino Royale, where he goes like, you know, just playing poker and just like dishing out chips or whatever, or where he just like, there's a magnet and he just goes nuts in a casino, right? He just like single-handedly ruins everyone's day. But he's fun. Like he's fun. Like he has this sort of scene in there where he goes, he just ruins like an underground casino, and he goes out and he just finds a truck. He goes into a truck and he just finds like a crowd of people who are just in his way. And he's like, excuse me, excuse me. Can you step aside, please? And he just, almost like Kermit the Frog. But, you know, so he's very polite. But he gets, I don't know, I find him, like, I don't buy him as in, like, there's totally a person like this. Like, but I buy it as in this movie universe, I can buy that there's Arnold Schwarzenegger plays a guy who's of Polish descent with a German accent because his name is Mark Kaminski, right? And then, you know, that he successfully infiltrated the Cosa Nostra or whatever. So, you know, I don't know. I like him.
As a guy named Joey.
Joey P. Brenner, right? Especially it's like, well, yeah. Like anyone who looks like this, infiltrate anything. Like, one thing I've learned always, right? There are people who are not skilled in the art will probably tell you, like, well, you know, maybe if you really stick out of the crowd, maybe you would actually make a successful spy or something. But people would never expect that someone who sticks out so much would be a spy. But then people who are actual spies or who are trained in finding spies, they'll be like, that's him. You know?
Yes.
Because it actually is a rule for a reason. The gray man is a rule for a reason. Like mid-built, mid-height, brown hair, brown eyes, whatever, average-looking dude. That's what you want, right? So it's just like, what did he look like? I don't know. Average. Doesn't right. give you anything. But meanwhile, this guy built like a brick
shit house. Did Joey Brenner look like?
Yeah, what does Joey Brenner like? Let me find him. So just let me phone someone.
Oh, Brenner. He must from Brenner. Florida. Brenner. He must be British or something. His last name's Brenner.
Exactly. But nope. Then, you know, like, what does he look like? And he goes like, built like a brick shit house. Doesn't move his arms when he walks, and he has a German accent. Oh. Totally remember him. Or like, I don't know, this is not the Brenner I know. So easy. So you don't even have to meet the guy or speak on the phone or whatever. It's just like, just a phone conversation is enough to know, like, this guy is not who he says he is.
Yeah, the ruse, true. Yeah, the ruse should be fairly easy to pick out. Sir, going back to Stallone, what did you say about Stallone? Did you see that Stallone would be more comfortable in this easier? Is that what you said?
Absolutely. Absolutely, okay, yeah. Yes.
When you first said it, I thought you said he wouldn't. But yeah, no, I would totally.
No, he would, yeah.
So like for where me, do you just, think...
Go ahead. No.
No, I was just going to sort of take the Stallone conversation and say,
sure, sure.
Between these two men, Stallone and Schwarzenegger, just wondering about talking a little bit about the evolution of the action hero in the 1980s from what it looked like in the 70s, and then it clearly turned into a thing that looked like Schwarzenegger and Stallone. Or would you say like this and Cobra are sort of turning points for, you know, the dumb action film, so sort of to use that phrase?
I'm not sure if they're turning points. I think the turning point for a dumb action film comes with like Lethal Weapon, Beverly Hills Cop. I think Beverly Hills Cop is probably just 48 Hours, maybe a little bit more. But 48 Hours is weirdly serious and very, very problematic. Because Nick Nolte in there is a racist. And he doesn't even hide it. It's very odd. It's very difficult to watch.
But Cobra and Raw Deal, I would suggest these are lone wolves. They're not buddy things, because the buddy thing is sort of evolving a little bit and turning into a piece around this time. But
because like they're both, so like out of the two, I think Cobra is more self-aware than Raw Deal, I would say. Cobra is kind of like a superhero film in a way. Like I kind of see it that way. I think talked about like episode, I don't know, something 60 something 70, I don't know. It was just me and Niccolo, I think. I don't know. But yeah, Cobra is one of those where I kind of feel like Stallone, like, well, Schwarzenegger could do a decent job doing Cobra, but it wouldn't be the best. Meanwhile, I think Stallone could outshine Schwarzenegger in Raw Deal. I think that's kind of how I see it. In terms of what the character, especially at the time, I mean, maybe later on, like in late 90s will be a different conversation, because I think like Schwarzenegger was way, way more self-assured and way more comfortable speaking. So there's that. But I think like, I'm not sure if they're like a turning point, because they're extremely serious in a way. Maybe Cobra is less serious than the other, because Cobra has these comedic elements just out of nowhere. Like he just cuts his pizza with scissors. And oh, maybe they're kind of alike, because like they're also very, very weirdly sort of fitness aware. Do you know how many calories are in there? Like, just when, or
yeah,
at the end of the film when he goes like, well, you know, put some chemicals in your body.
Yeah. I just find it interesting because Cobra's 85 or 86. It's right around here as well. And
I think it's 86, yeah. No, I think it's just the same year.
It might trying to remember, but I just find it's just right around here, because up until this point, not to sort of derail our conversation about Schwarzenegger and
talk about Cobra, right?
But Stallone's path is interesting as well, because he was an actor, right? So before Rocky came along, he had these other roles, and he was in Capone and Lords of Flatbush, I think it was called. Like he was an actor, and he made his way, like his opportunity being Rocky, but he was interested in writing scripts and directing. Like, it always fascinates me that he directed Staying Alive and then, you know, the second, third, fourth Rocky. So he's making his way behind the character, and it's almost as if he said, I can get my stardom sort of on a parallel path to this Schwarzenegger guy. It's almost as if Schwarzenegger came along and inspired Stallone to up his value in the marketplace as sort of this, you know, this body, this athlete type of leading man. Because before Schwarzenegger, I'd say Stallone's not really on that path. It's only after Schwarzenegger. But I just find they become contemporaries by the end of the 80s. And I would say, in a way, like Schwarzenegger has surpassed Stallone in terms of his market value, in terms of maybe his popularity and what have you. But
like artistically, Stallone is like not even in the same conversation.
I would agree with that. Just like his credentials, like being involved.
He's like Stallone is a writer first, I'd say this.
Yeah, he's a writer and an actor, and like he's a creative, and yeah, so like they're totally different animals, but they're contemporaries from around this time. So around, you know, Lockup, Cobra, Raw Deal, Command, like around this time, they're sort of contemporaries, and at least to mainstream audiences, they're sort of one in the same, except that one guy has these couple franchises, Rambo and Rocky, that he's working on, but they're sort of contemporaries. Mm-hmm. I just find that interesting because they come from such different backgrounds to sort of be equals.
There's an interesting sort of side conversation to this then, because well, first of all, like if we normalize acting to say that like Schwarzenegger is a regular actor, so in a universe where Schwarzenegger is a regular actor, and don't get me wrong, I really love the guy, in a universe where Schwarzenegger is a regular actor who's just a talented performer, then Stallone is Jack Nicholson. That's kind of the difference between the two in terms of talent, like, or the talent, or just the way they behave in front of the camera, the way they carry themselves. Like Stallone is extremely talented, extremely evocative. He's just on a different level. Like when he's in the same film, by the way, Cobra opened 2 weeks before Raw Deal. Oh,
okay.
Yeah.
So Cobra was a big hit. It was a huge moneymaker for, that was Canon, wasn't it? I think maybe.
It was the Canon group. Yes.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So here's the thing with Stallone, by the way, and this, there's a commonality to the two, I think, because like Stallone starts with like, people, I know there will be people who think like Rambo is this sort of like big muscular guy, and or Rocky is this sort of big muscle. Like, have you ever seen Rocky? Have you ever seen First Blood? You watch these two films, and these characters are not on display in there. This is
no, I agree. Not
even close, right? You watch Rocky 2, still not even close. You watch Rocky 3, still not even close, right? What happens in between? Like, if you look at and this is something that, okay, well, just apologies to anyone listening, just hoping for a conversation about Raw Deal, right?
Yes. Sorry.
So
abandoned this, that.
So I'm just clicking through Stallone's filmography to put it in context. Right. 1976, we have got Rocky, then Paradise Alley, Rocky II, 1979, Nighthawks, Escape to Victory, Rocky III, 1982. So, just a reminder, 1982 is when Schwarzenegger breaks out with Conan the Barbarian. 1982 is Rocky III and First Blood, right? Which both films, sorry, like one of the...
They were both what year? Sorry.
82.
You say 82 was Rocky III and First Blood?
First Blood and also Conan the Barbarian, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
So this is a time where also Rocky III, a guy directs this movie, writes it, and choreographs his boxing too, just because, right? In First Blood, he writes it, right? Meanwhile, Stallone's breaking onto the scene and just struggles through lines on Conan the Barbarian. They get tried to do 40 takes on the opening crawl and they cut it because he can't do it, right? Now, think about this. Meanwhile, 83... Let me just open Arnold's filmography just because... So 82, 84, you have Conan the Destroyer and you have The Terminator, yeah. Right? Big hits, yep. Right? Meanwhile, yep. 85, you yep. have First Blood Part 2. And yep. Hold on. And then later on, and you have Rocky 4.
Commando. Yep. Oh, yeah, okay, yep.
But then,
that's 85, so the common, it?
Yes, 85, you have... So 84, you have The Terminator for Schwarzenegger, which cements him as the sort of the big muscle man with a one-liner in it, right? And then 1985, you have First Blood Part 2. And what's the common feature of the two? James Cameron. Because James Cameron wrote Rambo 2.
Yeah.
And he was hired to write Rambo 2 because he wanted to do a sequel to Alien. And he said, I have a good idea for Alien sequel. And they told him, you can do an Alien film he wanted to do an Alien sequel, and they said you can do this if the film you're making, The Terminator, is going to make a lot of money. You can have that, because that was, I think, I'm not sure if it was Carolco, maybe it was like a Mario Casar, Andrew Viner. No, I don't know. But then he scores these two gigs, Aliens and Rambo 2, at the same time. He writes them both, right? So what does he do with Rambo 2? He essentially just capitalizes on his own success, because he knows, like, well, this muscle man I wrote, the sort of the Terminator I did, I can do it again. I feel like this is it. So James Cameron is who's responsible for this sort of image of Sylvester Stallone as a Schwarzenegger minor.
You might be onto something. So Milius brought it to the forefront and then Cameron ran with it.
Mm-hmm. And then Cameron ran with it, and then Cameron kind of cross-pollinated this onto this Stallone sort of persona, when Stallone had a perfectly cool career as a writer-director as well.
Mm-hmm.
And because Rocky IV is a market changed for, like, between Rocky III is a film where Rocky is not a superhero. He's not a, you know, lean sort of shredded sort of pile of muscle. He's a guy who's ready to retire. He has to stand up to an oppressive bully. That's Mr. T. Come on, boy. You know, it's a different film. It has more in common with Rocky 1 and 2 than it has with Rocky 4. Right? Rocky 3 is one of those.
Right. Well, Rocky 4 is political. Rocky 4 is the biggest of them.
Yes.
But sorry.
But in the meantime, you have Rambo 2 that kind of just makes, I think this is the movie that makes the switch. It's not Cobra, Rambo 2 is the film that actually just makes the switch towards the dumb film. Even though I would still contend that Rambo 2 is actually still one of those films that still is, it's not the American rara stupidity. It's still very sort of pro, let's bring our boys home, what have we done, sort of has this sort of political stance. But you can see, like, he just shoots bows and arrows. He shoots arrows at helicopters, okay? So, and they explode.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think this is the movie that's the switch. Not Cobra, not Rodeal. That's Rambo 2 is the, and smack in the middle of the 80s too.
Yeah, too, on the bigger scale. I think you're right. What I still think, though, that Cobra and Raw Deal do in their own way is they allow, so these types of films here that, like, Cobra, Raw Deal, they're sort of a smaller affair. They're not the Rambo 2, and they're not T2 or anything like that. Those are exceptional big studio tentpole films. But what I think Raw Deal and Cobra and Commando sort of do is they allow this action hero athlete image to be applied to the 1970s model of an action movie. Because I think in the 1970s, what we get for action heroes are Charles Bronson, cop movies, revenge movies, car chase movies. So the Burt Reynolds, Charles Bronson type of stuff. Steve McQueen is in there. But now it's becoming a little bit more of a spectacle because we want to have car chases and we want to have explosions and we start to get all these 80s cliches come. But I think that...
he fakes his death in such a spectacular way.
That's an amazing explosion. The pyrotechnics on that are just phenomenal.
Do you think they were surprised with the scale of the explosion when they set it off? They were like, shit, this is bigger than we thought.
I don't know. But it was great. But I think like Raw Deal and Commando and Cobra, they allow the big hulking guy to be Burt Reynolds or Charles Bronson because they were just ordinary dudes or Bill Devane. So I see that, and maybe what it is Cannon and DEG, so De Laurentiis, they just say, you know what? Where can we get an action script? Let's get one of those action scripts that are, you know, just floating around Hollywood, and they get something that is inspired by 70s stuff, inspired by, you know, White Lightning or Brannigan or whatever the hell, those types of 70s action films or cop films or chase films or whatever. They get something inspired by the 70s and they say, well, the new big shots in town are sort of the big muscle men, the athletes. So let's give this to a Stallone or Arnold and make sure it has a low budget. So I wonder if just because it's a low hanging fruit, let's just sort of grab an ordinary action film. Let's put in one of these big guys. So I see that there is sort of a movement here away from, you know, the Steve McQueen type of hero, because, you know, by the time we get to Showdown in Little Tokyo and some of the, you know, well, Mark Lester, I guess he was in on Commando, but the heroes in the end of the 90s are the Dolph Lundgrens, and, you know, there's a whole slew of these guys straight to video, like the Dudikoffs and whatever. Jean-Claude Van Damme shows up in these Dudikoffs types of films.
I need some Dudikoff films on my shelf. Like, someone needs to start releasing them on Blu-ray. I think some, like, American Ninja, I can buy.
Yeah, I don't really know this guy at all. I don't know if I've seen any Dudikoff films. But there is a transition that... Yeah, okay, I got to fill in that gap.
I mean, they're not good, like, at all. But, you know, like, I don't need to see many.
After I see some Chuck Norris, and maybe he belongs in here, too. Because Chuck Norris American is sort Ninja, of... The,
sorry, American Ninja and Chain of Command. Watch these two. Just saying.
Okay. Just a sec. Chain of Command. Noted.
And American Ninja.
And that's been on my radar for a long time.
Okay. There's like five of them, but I think Dudikoff is in like the first three.
Okay.
And that's also, they are all canon, I think.
Probably. So, yeah, and Chuck Norris, maybe he's sort of the transition piece because he's sort of athlete, I guess, to a point. But he looks sort of like the heroes of the 70s. Anyway, my point is I can act, true. True. So anyway, I feel that there's a transition, just all layers of the business, like the studio tent poles, the $10 million productions that Canon's putting out, the straight to video stuff that is a $2 million budget, like, straight across the board, we want, like, a leading man has to have muscles. They have to be an athlete. Like, God, by 1990, you have, like, linebackers and stuff. Bosworth, the heck was his first name?
Bosworth?
Not Kate Bosworth, but there was a guy who used to play at the Seattle Seahawks football player.
Brian Bosworth.
Brian Bosworth, thank you. So he's in Craig Baxley's film Stone Cold. And this is the type of thing that we get. It's the muscle men. And I think it's turning right around here. So, yeah, and it's, you know, it's a sort of a slow evolution over the course of 10 or 15 years. But I think from the 70s to the 90s, I think you can point to something like Raw Deal and say, well, somewhere along the way, they let these muscle men just play normal dudes that end up in action situations.
I mean, I guess that's where I see it. But I think this is like you're outlining this as a very interesting sort of like a thought experiment, right? Because like I think we forgot to mention that this film is based on a story written by two dudes who used to write for Sergio Leone and Dino De Laurentiis. So Sergio Donati and Luciano Vincenzoni. Vincenzoni, yes? That's the two. So imagine, like, the guy, Sergio Donati, he wrote, he has a writing credit on Once Upon a Time in the West. He's a has a credit on For a Few Dollars More, DocuSucker. And the other guy, imagine this, the guy has a credit on in order, he has DocuSucker, Orca, 1977, which is also, ooh, I think, an Italian production, right?
If, yep, I remember correctly. Yeah.
Yeah. Then he has Raw Deal, and then he has Once Upon a Crime, and then he has Malena for Vittorio Tornatore, right? Is it Tornatore?
Who are you looking at, Donati?
Yeah, no, Vincenzoni.
Okay.
Yeah, Giuseppe Tornatore, sorry. That's the one. So he wrote that film. So imagine this, that these are the sort of old school genre guys. So the story they wrote is a very sort of typical cliche of the time, right? So I think the thought experiment is like, let's write, you know, like a Rolling Thunder. Let's write like The Outfit, or I don't know. Let's write something that, you know, like Don Siegel or Sam Peckinpah would direct with, you know, Clint Eastwood, Steve McQueen, or Charlie Bronson, or William Devane at the helm, right? And let's put this hulking superhero in and see what happens, right? And it kind of looks like what happens is the guy is kind of like the Incredible Hulk. He can hold it in for so long, but eventually it turns into a massacre, right? Where he, like, at the end of the film, Schwarzenegger looks like the Terminator after he didn't infiltrate shit in this film. The Terminator didn't infiltrate anything. He just walked into places and massacred people, right? So after he assaulted the police station, so he's just like, he's this sort of shattered jacket. He's just blood pouring out of him. He just doesn't care. So it's kind of like what happens when you put John Matrix and, you know, the Terminator in a police procedural. It's a weird sort of hybrid that you get, but at least for, I want to say, a good half of it, I think it's almost like Schwarzenegger's trying to be in disguise. Like, he's trying to kind of calm himself down. He's trying to kind of play it straight. And I appreciate that, because, like, there's a scene in here, for instance, where he gets ready to go and take out the mobsters at the end. Like, he goes into the gravel pit, and then from there he goes directly into the big building, I don't know, the casino or whatever the hell, the hotel, right? But then he gets himself ready, which is a carbon copy of Commando, right? So you get this, you know, the gun porn of just checking or unloading guns and just putting all these belts on. And he has this white wife beater on, slicked back hair, so it kind of looks like he's just like a slimmed down Commando. He's not trying to kind of just ham it up. He's trying to play it straight, as though like Commando was a real thing. So that's, for me, this is the allure of the movie. It's kind of like, let's pretend this is for real for a second, but still do it anyway. It's interesting. Just pretend it's real.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about this, because in a way, the action film replaced the Western, or the cop film replaced the Western, and then sort of the action film replaced the cop film, you know, to a point. So, and this is something you might get in a Western. That's right.
Yes.
So
it's a Western. In a Western, go item.
That's exactly right. In a Western, you might have the bad guys roll into town and just shoot the hell out of things. And that would be, you know, that would be action in the 60s. And that's really what it's turned into. Only in a world where in the 80s, everything was in an abandoned warehouse or a work site or a gravel pit. You know, there's always equipment around. So you can certainly check heavy equipment off the, you know, the 80s movie bingo item, because there's always like bulldozers and that type of thing.
Guy with an assault rifle just guarding a gravel pit. I'm just like, no one ever questioned why is there so much security at this gravel pit, and then you go into this they have this sort of shipping container office, and then there's like $1 million in $1 bills in on the table just because.
Yeah, again, like that's another item off the 80s checklist right there. The other piece I might money. Just to talk about a little bit, just to throw this thought in there about Schwarzenegger himself. And what really impresses me with him, and just sort of watching a bunch of his films and, you know, having these conversations around his work, I can't help but think that the fact that his bodybuilding career, which involves so much time on stage and maybe hamming it up for photographers, the confidence and the swagger working with his audience is what made Schwarzenegger a star. You know, I'm saying this too, having seen the Lou Ferrigno Hercules this week. And, you know, that man just could not get through a line of dialogue. But Schwarzenegger knows how to play the camera. He knows how to deal with other people. And there's almost there's a genuine characteristic in him in here. As hard as he is trying to, you know, act and, you know, push himself and challenge himself and, you know, still get the dialogue right and all these other things that he's working on, there's a little bit of a heart that you can detect in his performance. And I wonder if Schwarzenegger himself sort of said, as sort of top dog and top billing, like, I want to include this line about being healthy. Like, there's things in here that are sort of meaningful, I would say, to Schwarzenegger. And you get to see him be human a little bit, like the stuff where he walks in and he sees his wife, like that's just, that's fairly poor dialogue in a way. It's fairly clunky, and he, you know, he just does what he does with it. But there's a genuine element, I feel, when he's dealing with Darren McGavin, like his buddy at the FBI. And especially at the end, we actually see Schwarzenegger
as a bit of a
coach, right? Because he has a passion for helping other people and being a good guy. And he has this coaching and this kind warmth to him in the last, you know, 2 minutes or so of the movie. And I would say there's something that's really endearing about Schwarzenegger in that. Like, you know, you can sort of piss on the scene and say, oh, we don't need it, and it doesn't necessarily do that much, except to me it sort of speaks that there is a guy beneath. He can be sort of a normal guy. It does sort of raise his stock as an actor in my mind, because he can give a little bit of something. You don't have to be Cameron and work around Schwarzenegger because he can't speak English that well, you know, so we'll only give him 20 lines in the whole film. You don't have to tiptoe around the guy's limitations because he is a bit of a human underneath it. I get a little bit of that at points in this that's sort of coming out. And I don't know if Schwarzenegger's pushing for this himself. I want to do a scene where I get to be a coach and motivate. I don't know. I could see that certainly later
Come on,
in his career.
You can do it. You can do it. Yeah.
Just so anyway, what are your thoughts on this angle in his performance?
Well, the fitness angle? Or...
Well, the fitness and sort of there is an authenticity to him, and there's a bit of a heart that he's capable of hitting.
Like, you know, authenticity is out the window the minute he walks into a house where his wife is baking a cake, and he, like, with a physique like this, you do not eat cake. Cake is not consuming this house.
Yes,
like, just saying, you know, it's kind of like instead of, you know, like, whatever he says.
You should not drink and bake.
He should have said, you should have known not to bake a cake in the first place. You know? Kale is what we eat. And beef. Yes. Sirloin. Okay? Beef steak. Tomahawk. That's what we eat in here. Elk. He's like Joe Rogan, just bison. All the way. So she should be just, like, this whole house should just smell of fried meat. That's kind of what it is. So it's authenticity out the window already. But I kind of like the idea. I kind of forgot where I was going with this because I get overwhelmed by the fitness.
I'm looking for a comp to the end where we see sort of what I would say is maybe it's a genuine compassion for his buddy, not for his wife.
Yeah, the wife kind of just like, for some reason, I actually thought that there was going to be a twist because, like, Amy's pregnant. I'm just like, he was undercover. So, I don't know. But if I feel like this is almost like a, I don't want to say it's an inside joke, and it will make an appearance later on, but the, so the ending of like, oh, come on, you can do it, do it. And he's forcing him to walk. It's an element of trying to humanize the character after essentially just reminding the viewer that, you know, like, oh, no, no, he's a superhero anyway, because he's just dispatched the entire Chicago mafia without breaking a sweat, right?
Yeah. So do you think, as far as this is humanizing the character, do you think it's too little too late for the film? Because actually, for me, it actually sort of resonates. It's like, this is a really weird, genuine moment to leave off on. It actually sort of works between McGavin.
I stop at weird.
So a little, too little, too late. Yeah, and yes, weird, but, like out of place.
I mean, yeah, I see what they're doing, and I don't necessarily think I ever had problems humanizing him as a character. Sure, it's difficult to kind of get over the fact that he looks like a, you know, a bodybuilder trying to pretend that he's a mobster, right? It's kind of what it is. But I think he's, you know, he's doing it quite well. He's just like when he interacts with Catherine Harold, for instance, like he's very natural. He's very likable. I kind of like him. He almost plays it. That's the character. What's her name? Monique. The one who goes to casinos and she never wins any money. So, which means to me that she should Catherine probably Harold. Stop going to casinos.
Really should. Yeah, Monique.
Monique, that's her name. And they have some fun, cool scenes together, because, you know, they get drunk and they just, like, they drink wine, they laugh, and then, like, when, like, you have to also, you have to get over the fact that whenever, like, Arnold laughs, he doesn't laugh like you and me, like, he just, the orifice that he has on his face is massive, okay? And it's square. But I'm pretty sure he's not humming it up. It's just this is how he exists. Like, when he laughs, you can see into his stomach, you know?
I took the laughing as him maybe trying too hard and not nailing it. There's a couple instances where he's laughing, and it's just this really weird, awkward sound, and I wonder if that's, you know, him acting the laugh, and it's just not quite coming out right. Like, it really does stand out as sort of weird in a couple moments in this mm-hmm. film. So, about the wife, we might as well talk about her. What do you think about the setup of the film? The setup of the film. The setup of the film, it's bookended with our hero, sort of in North Carolina, in his sort of domestic, his real world life, not undercover at any rate. And we see him chase down a bad guy. He's a sheriff. And then he goes home and his wife is drunk making a cake and then throws the cake at him, which is the source of our great soundbite. and then he has this opportunity to go work undercover, doesn't tell anyone, and he fakes his death. What do you think of the conceits here? Like
you should not tell anyone.
Yes. So he totally leaves his wife in the dark. So I don't know. Like, for me, it's really crazy, really silly. And I think I got a lot of criticism too. But, you know, for me, it's just, these are plot points that sort of roll off my back. Sort of it's low-hanging fruit, as long as you succeed in the action and sort of the pacing and where we're going with this. I can look past a lot of this stuff, but what do you think about sort of the narrative setup and the book ending pieces and the wife in here and the fake death and all this exposition?
Cliche, right?
Yeah.
That's to me, this is the setup to a Hong Kong film, like an early John Woo film, right? Where just like there's this police officer and I don't know, he needs to pay off his mortgage. So he doesn't tell his wife, he fakes his own death, and he comes back and he gets her pregnant later on because she's totally not upset that he fakes his own death. because you know, because we're in a Hong Kong film. So and on this level, I just excuse it like this. Mm-hmm. I just say like this is.
And
just,
I do too. How does a film like this elevate beyond that though? How does this become a special piece of cinema?
Does it have to? Like, does it have to elevate? Like,
if it wanted, if it wanted to.
I mean, if it did want to elevate and become something special, then sure. But I think, you know, genre familiarity is something that I kind of just hold near and dear to my heart. Like, there are films where, you know, like, you don't necessarily need to reinvent the wheel. This doesn't have to be the Terminator. That you don't have to break the mold. You don't have to, I don't know, think outside the box. You can still exist well within the box, play by the book. And I think it's actually what the elevation comes with just the simple act of casting this guy in a film that would be otherwise out of character for him, right? So I think this is where the elevation comes in. And you can just execute on the genre and you're still getting something elevated. So I think this is where the elevation comes from. Because otherwise, like if you just forget that there's Schwarzenegger in here, that he's this 6'3" or 6'2" guy who just weighs just quite a bit more than I do, right? And he looks like he has to just walk through doorways sideways, right? If you forget that, it's a canonical genre film, right? That's just what it is, right? So it doesn't execute on anything new. There are these setups. There's the guy who's he's infiltrating some kind of an outfit. There's one guy in the outfit who doesn't really trust that he says he is. So there's this sort of cat and mouse of trying to figure out who's gonna get there faster, and then the confrontation between these two, and then whatever. So it's all executing on something that you've seen 100 times before, right? But the novelty comes in the fact that Neil Schwarzenegger is in it. So that's what's new and fresh. And you don't have to do anything special with it anymore. And it's still fun.
You know, I think you hit it on the head right there. Because in my mind, if you and I are producing this film and we want to make a film as DEG did, and they wanted to make a quick book, they wanted to make a quick buck, and they grab a script, they grab these experienced guys that throw genre stuff together. And the guys that came up with the story, they've got a history, you know, in the Italian industry, and the guys that write the screenplay, they've got their toes in sort of the modern action and stuff. How do you make this special in terms of making it like a sales pitch that would appeal to audiences? And I think what they did, it is in the casting. Maybe this is hiring Stallone or Schwarzenegger is sort of the stunt casting that maybe makes it feel special because they are these supermen in everyday mm-hmm. clothes. Maybe
that's kind of, and I like, that's kind of what you do, right?
Yeah.
You just hire, oh yeah, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, like, I think you're right on that. That's what the game plan was. That's what makes this stand out in the marketplace on video store shelves, and if you're selling it to theaters or whatever. In my head, I'm thinking, if you have a set piece, like a special set piece, that's what makes things stand out. And this is sort of the era for that, as we're getting from Lucas and Spielberg, like these very special set pieces. The adventure of Indiana Jones is back in the public consciousness. So maybe you do something with a special set piece. I'm not convinced Rod Deal does much of that, although I would suggest The Quarry tries its best, and that's as close as it gets.
For me, The Quarry is like one of those more almost underwhelming action sequences. Really? I think for one reason, really. I mean, every time you hide Arnold Schwarzenegger in a car, you kind of lose momentum.
Really? Why do you... I don't...
Go ahead. He succeeds more with a sort of hands-on action, as in like when he just walks into rooms and kills people. This is where he succeeds. Where he drives, it's just like it could be anyone. So I don't know if it's Schwarzenegger driving a car. So the novelty of having this big hulking sort of ex Mr. Olympia in here kind of dissipates a little bit.
Okay.
So I feel I get more of what you get, the set piece sort of feel out of the set piece that comes right after it, where he goes and just, well, they have this moment like just like, I don't know, just goes through, like sends an elevator down and they shoot at the elevator, and just like he makes such a racket while sliding down some kind of a shaft. And then he just starts dispatching these people. And this is where, for me, this movie becomes fun again, because there's blood everywhere. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, he's just driving a car. And then when he gets out of the car and just takes people out, and like, fuck yeah.
Yeah, I'm with you there too. What I would say, like, I don't mind Schwarzenegger in a vehicle. And I find there's almost a novel element to that, because he is the guy who should be flexing, and he should be down to the, you know, the tank top or the t-shirt, and we should be seeing his muscles bulge, and that's sort of what I'm used to. So to see him in a vehicle, driving the vehicle, to me, there's a novelty, almost like Twins, almost like Reitman would later on, a few years after this, discover the novelty in putting Arnold in these different situations or scenes or scenarios or visuals. So just the optics. So I find when he's driving the Jeep, that's sort of interesting and engaging. The piece where he drives into the gravel pit, I like seeing him in the vehicle there, because Arnold's size impacts that scene as he's driving too, because he's got this massive gun. He's not just shooting a pistol. He's shooting a machine gun with one hand while driving. So there's a bit of a spectacle with that, which I sort of enjoy that scene for. So, you know, that's my take on that.
Like there are more car scenes in there. Like when they have these like hits, when he's sitting there in the back seat of a car with like five other like sad hitmen, and he's trying to, and they're shooting at each other. It's essentially like a western, but just, you know, I don't know. But
yes,
it kind of just loses the appeal immediately because he's hidden somewhere. So I mean,
yeah, that scene is not very memorable. I totally agree.
Yeah, and I'm just saying, like, when you say, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger in a vehicle is fine, for me, like, in a vehicle, it's too general a statement. In a car, not memorable. Arnold Schwarzenegger has a big persona, so he needs to be in an appropriately big vehicle to make you remember. Make the set piece kind of just work in tandem with the character. So he needs to be in a Harrier jet. Then you then you remember him. Like, he needs to be in a Hummer.
Or in his Hummer, yeah,
or on a motorcycle where you can see him, or he has to be in a massive truck.
I watched Gator. Have you ever seen Gator, the Burt Reynolds film?
Mm-mm, no, I don't think I have.
No, okay. So I watched that last week, and it's not that great. Anyway, there's a henchman who's in that, who's like 7 feet tall. So they're using the spectacle of size or whatever, and every time he drives the main bad guy around, he's sitting in a vehicle that has a sunroof, and his head sticks out of the sunroof. He's driving down the street this way, and it's played for comedy. It looks so ridiculous, but at the same time, it must be incredibly dangerous, because if this guy, you know, stops quickly and he, you know, jams his throat anyway. So the big guy in a small vehicle. Like
Bubba Smith in, is it Bubba Smith? Oh, in Police Academy? Yeah,
Police Academy, sits in the back seat.
Yeah, but this is, again, like, so this is how you make it memorable. Just, like, play it for comedy. Just stick him in a Yugo or whatever, something small. And and then it becomes memorable because it's fun. But in here, when you try to play it straight, you kind of lose the gimmick of hiring Superman, John Matrix / the Terminator, right, Conan the Barbarian, and put him in a suit. And then having him actually still go and just saw destruction, right?
Yeah,
because that's what it is. It's like the 80s meets the 70s. Look, like, for it's almost kind of like okay, to put it in bodybuilding terms, because it's Arnold, right? Because like, if you compare Arnold in terms of bodybuilding, Arnold in his prime to someone who would be his equivalent now, like if he had to compete now, he'd be like twice as he'll be half the size of people who are competing in like these sort of open classes. Like, they had to invent special categories, like, called, I think they're called classic physique, where they actually have weight limits so they don't go really nuts with just taking steroids and eating loads of meat, so they don't grow into these stupid sizes, right?
Yeah,
but then, like, he would be like, even if you compare him to against like Phil Heath or Ronnie Coleman, he's just small, right? Yeah. So it's kind of like the equivalent of like if Ronnie Coleman was transported back in time to compete in 1976 Mr. Olympia, people wouldn't have any idea how to deal with it. So it's kind of like now in film terms, like Arnold Schwarzenegger is the sort of the evolution of Clint Eastwood, and now he gets to come and star in Dirty Harry, and then like the story doesn't know how to deal with it, so all he does is just kills everyone with ease. He doesn't even break a sweat, which is the gimmick of the film, right?
Yeah.
80s yeah, killing agreed. 70s.
What do you think of the villains in here? Is there anything? Is there anything in the evolution of, because we've talked about the evolution of villains, just insofar as we've theorized that Alan Rickman is sort of a node and a bit of a turning point, and we're before Rickman. We're in the pre-Rickman era. What do you think of the villains in this? Do they matter?
You close your eyes and imagine like an Italian mobster from a 70s film. You'll exactly imagine what this movie gives you. Like it's all by the book, and it's fine.
Yeah.
Right? Because it's the gimmick, like, you know, of like we're taking a by the book genre piece from the 70s and then let's stick Arnold in and see how many people he kills in 5 minutes. So that's kind of what it is. So the villains are very unmemorable in a way, but I don't mind because all I'm here for is to see them die. So, and then there are a few moments in here where they do, let's just say, the villains are kind of a bit more, like you can see how they lose their inhibitions a little bit because maybe the 70s, or maybe early 70s or 60s, I suppose, would be a little bit more tame, where the film kind of feels like it's trying to be like a Sam Peckinpah type genre affair, where, you know, like these guys show up and they just execute a witness, and they just witness this, and they just shoot him through the face. So that these would be like these very sparse moments. But other than that, it's kind of like, I've seen this before and I don't mind because I'm seeing this again, but this time with the difference of this guy who he lifts people and throws them out the windows. And, you know, yeah. And when he runs away because they were, again, another sort of scene of like Arnold Schwarzenegger shopping for clothes with a woman. So I don't mind sitting here. And just like, you just want to get laid, son. And he just sits there with his like hands on his laps. Like he's just like he's like Mark Zuckerberg, like he's aware of how he needs to act to look human.
Yes. But, yeah.
Yeah.
The other thing I might say about the villains in here, and it's always interesting when talking about villains in the history of film, because right now we're sort of in the era, I think in the 80s, there's this attitude, at least in Hollywood, that, you know, the hero has to win and the bad guys are all evil. And then further to that, the bad guys are either Russians or drug dealers. So, and here they're drug dealers, right? So whoever the villains are in the film, they tend to be the villains in the newspaper that same era. So this here film is undeniably, for any one of a number of reasons, an 80s film, and, you know, just looking at the villains, that's part of it as well. I find that interesting. Well, just
with, you know, a, with a twist, though, because there's the other villain in there, right? That was Marvin Baxter, his character's name is, like the FBI prosecutor who turns out that he's the one leaking special agents to the mob so that they get offed.
And this is proof that it's a remnant of a 70s idea.
this is like a Nixon type sort of, like, you can't trust the government.
You can't trust authority, and true.
So for me, this is again plays into the playbook, and it's fine because
I'm here
for is Arnold destruction, right?
Yep, it's a body count film because that turns into, you know, what it is in the 80s to a certain point.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, I'm starting to run out of thoughts. Do you know John Irvin? Just to bring up the director a little bit here, I don't really know this man. I remember seeing Hamburger Hill.
He did Hamburger Hill. And he did.
Hamburger Hill, yeah.
Is it not Hamburger?
I remember seeing that. Hamburger Hill.
Hamburger Hill? Or
Yeah, Hamburger Hill. I saw that ages ago, and I thought that was a really, really boring war movie. But other than that, I don't have too much history with the guy, so I was just wondering if you did. I think he's just a decent hired gun, understands the assignment, goes about his business. Mm-hmm. He just seems to be one of those type of journeymen, but...
He did The Dogs of War, and I haven't seen the film, but I remember reading... I tried reading the book, because there was a time in my young life when I discovered Frederick Forsyth, and wrote I read The Day of the Jackal. I was just like, this is amazing, let's read The Dogs of War. I'm just like, I don't want to finish this book. Why? I barely remember it, but yeah. My dad used to like these. Like, just kind of how I found these books, because they were just on the shelf in the house. I think I've seen Hamburger Film Hill years and years ago, but I can't remember a single thing about it. So it doesn't, like, again, like, this is one of those films that doesn't really inform you that there's an author behind the camera, right? Because everything's kind of just like, we're here to do a job, and the job is to make this sort of Hong Kong film. I mean, they didn't know what they were doing. Hong Kong. We're doing like an approximation of a Hollywood film in here. That's kind of what we're doing.
Yeah. They're tackling it the exact same way as Ringo Lam and John Woo and some of these guys. Yeah, they're just looking at it the same way. Let's try to do this. Yeah. I agree. I don't really have anything else to add to this. I think that it is what it is. So why don't we lead this into our final thoughts? Unless you have anything else on your radar.
Not much. I'll just say, like, I appreciate this film for what it is. It's, you know, again, it's like an academic... sort of stimulating experience for me, because it gets me to think about one of my favorite sort of action stars in a different context. I'm happy to have revisited this, and I enjoy this as an experiment, almost, where you're trying to kind of just calm down John Matrix Commando and then just remove his self-awareness almost completely and see what happens, right? And what happens is interesting, but it's also very uncompelling to general audiences, because it turns out that, you know, like, this is how you prove mathematically that things are true. By removing the variable, you prove its importance, right? So if you remove this, and that means, like, well, maybe you have to kind of just take this box office bomb and learn that, okay, well, you really need Arnold to deliver one-liners. You need him to be self-aware and very fun. He needs to be playful, because he's not at all playful in here. And when he eventually just at some point sometimes is, it feels out of place, because the entire character is built around the idea of being very self-serious. So 3.5 out of 5 for me. I would say it's totally an Uncut Gem, specifically in the context of Arnold Schwarzenegger's filmography. It's definitely an item to check out to see, like, this is what happens when you take this sort of superhero action man and strip him down of his, like, just feed him kryptonite, you know, and see what happens. You know, it turns out then, you know, like, kryptonite has a, you know, residency time in your body of like 24 to 48 hours, and he poops it out and he's back at it.
Yes.
and then he goes into a gravel pit and ruins people's day. But yeah, 3.5 out of 5. Uncut Gem. Really like it. Wouldn't recommend it to my mom.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect. Perfect. For me, yes, I think that as a project, Raw Deal was very much meant as a moneymaker. It never had lofty goals or ambitions. It is a case of, you know, let's try to reach with this project the lowest hanging fruit. So it grabs genre story. It gets genre writers to, you know, write the genre screenplay. And it's handed off to a gentleman, John Irvin, who just knows he understands the assignment, and he's not necessarily out to do anything too terribly special with it. And then you've got Arnold in the mix. It's interesting, I find, like, because it's an early point in Schwarzenegger's career, I think that there is a little bit of sort of fun, authentic humanity that sort of creeps out. Like the Arnold Schwarzenegger I know from his Facebook posts and from his other films, and just that fun, caring, experienced guy. I think that sort of creeps through a little bit. Sometimes his performance is forced, but that's where he is in his career. This film is about the spectacle. It's the And thank you very much, Jakob. This has been a fun conversation, sort of, you know, talking about the 80s action and comparing it to 70s action. And let's sort of look at the parallels to Stallone. It's interesting to look at this film in that context and what it meant for that era and what it meant for, you know, Schwarzenegger and what have you. So very interesting conversation. But yeah, this is a film that, because it doesn't have lofty goals, the biggest thing it could do wrong was not meet them. And in that regard, it met them. It's perfectly fine. It is what it is. And it's sort of fun. And you do sort of have to leave the inhibitions at the door and say, okay, I'm going to enjoy this for what it is. But what I will say is that films like this get a bad rep because it's described as, you know, the stupid film or whatever. And that comes with the baggage of being the lowest hanging fruit. But you said it earlier at one point, does it have to be more? Well, maybe to be a 5-star film, it does. But, you know, why can't it just sort of be what it is and have fun and just be entertaining mm-hmm. and chug along successfully? This film does that. So when something is just explained, well, it's just a stupid action movie. It doesn't deserve the negativity that goes along with that connotation. Right. Yeah, perfect. So, yeah, that's how I feel about Raw Deal. So, yeah, as an uncut gem, I would give this sort of a sturdy 3 stars out of 5. And, yeah, I enjoyed watching
it. Sounds fair, because I kind of feel like I enjoyed it a little bit more than you did. So, like, 3.5 versus 3 kind of makes sense. And 3.5 is a good amount of stars, by the way. Like, just be honest. Like, it's not like a... You know, it's not a failure.
3 is a recommendation from me. So yeah, for sure.
Sometimes I feel like 2.5 is almost a recommendation from me. Sometimes I just feel like
I feel the same way. 2.5 is sort of my sitting on the fence. It could, because on Letterboxd, for instance, I'll give it a star if I recommend it, or I won't give it a star if I don't recommend it. So I have some 2.5s that have the star and some that don't. So anyway. Moving to our top 3. Please share. Goodness. What's your top 3 list look like?
I've got, like, you gotta give an honorable mention to...
You should not drink and bake.
Because this is the epitome of this movie's trying to do. This is a one-liner. And it's, like, hear how it's delivered.
You should not drink and bake.
It's completely non-self-aware. He's just making a comment to this woman. And it's fascinating to me. Okay, another one I've got. When he fakes his death and he just leaves the car and just gets a motorcycle and drives away, and this explosion just puts to shame Chris Nolan's sort of The Dark Knight hospital blowing up. This
might be a hot take. It almost, in my mind, put to shame the nuclear bomb in Oppenheimer.
Jesus, like, this is a lot of fuel. Like, holy Christ, this. And just, it was all done in camera. Just, have you seen Raw Deal? Like, all these effects in Oppenheimer were done in camera. Like, and it's like, and imagine that. Like,
all,
they were also done
all in these Raw effects. Deal,
and there was a guy on a bike in front of it.
Yeah. The whole Oppenheimer thing, I got to say that, you know, all these effects were done in camera. There's hardly any computer graphics. All these effects, there's one explosion. Christ.
Yeah, I know.
Sorry.
But no, like, no. Like,
the film about the Senate hearing? All the effects in that film about the Senate hearing? Okay.
Yeah. Where I get to be annoyed at RDJ for an hour?
Yeah.
Why is he here? Or just, no, hold on. Okay. But, where Albert Einstein comes out of nowhere whenever it's convenient. Like, he just hides behind a car once to deliver someone a paper. Right, I thought about this. I'm like, where the fuck did you come from?
It's like a Simpsons moment. Yeah, sorry. And Oppenheimer is a 3-star film for a totally different set of reasons.
Well, it's a 2-star film for me, but you know.
Okay.
Especially it's like, oh, you know, what do people know about the Robert Oppenheimer? I know. I am become deaf, the destroyer of world. And you know what we're going to do? Florence Pugh is going to take a book off the shelf at random, ask him to recite a line. And this is going to be this line in Sanskrit that he's going to translate to her while he's banging her. While he's coming.
Where's that soundbite?
My neighbors are very sensitive.
I've got only Arnie.
Not that one. Okay.
Like, you know, like,
God, just, yeah.
You know, that's the...
You should not drink and bake.
That's what I want to say to Chris Nolan when he's writing.
Yeah, and sorry, I got to get this.
And
gotta
people unload like, this five stars, masterpiece. The best movie of the year. Like, fuck.
I am absolutely thrilled that teenagers are going to three-hour ass-numbing films about quantum physics and the start of the Cold War. That makes me very happy. So this film can keep making money.
Exactly.
But it's a, like, but it's a biopic. Like, okay, it's a biopic with one explosion. Christ almighty.
I'm so happy these teenagers got tricked into learning some history, but they tricked into watching a biopic by under the guise that they were watching it backwards.
Yeah.
So innovative. No one's done a biopic like this. I mean, like...
That's true. That's true. This should have been like a four-part miniseries, like modeled off of Chernobyl. Anyway.
Yeah.
Total derailment. So
where was I?
Our top threes for raw deal, not
Oppenheimer. How many times has John Wayne been nominated? Not enough. That's a good line.
Yeah.
Okay. Opening shootout, the invasion on this of the safe house. What a sequence. Did I mention the explosion? I did, yeah. I really, really like this. And the final all these action sequences are great. I like how he throws a guy and then he just hangs out on a pipe somewhere and just like decides to stay there just to avoid being killed. But there's sort of the scene where I really always remember is when he's this sort of the John Matrix commando scaled down to normality because he ate kryptonite still getting ready for a fight of his life. Like when he just takes it out of his closet and he has all this arsenal, and I really like this sort of the gun porn of it all when he's saying slicked back hair. He looks great, he looks almost normal. I really enjoy it. That's me.
Okay. Cool good list. All right. I've just got a list, and I didn't label it correctly. I don't know what are honorables and what are actuals, so I'll just start listing things that I liked in this movie. And I've been pretty good all year with just sticking with three or four in my top three, but I might have five or six here. So anyway,
to top sevens.
Yeah. Just for Arnold month. Just for Arnold month.
There is no bathroom.
An honorable has to go to the suit bag. He takes a suit bag out of the closet, puts it on the bed, unzips it, and it's just loaded with guns. That's cool.
Absolutely.
Gotta say. I like the mob meeting. So this is a scene that has nothing to do with Arnold whatsoever, but there's a mob meeting at a funeral home's coffin sales floor. I just think that's a great location to have a meeting. So all these open caskets for sale around them. I think that's great. During the rock quarry car chase, shoot 'em up gunfight, which I really love, there's a great moment in there where a mannequin falls into the rock grinder. That actually looks really good. I had to watch that a couple times. And it's like, yes, when you watch it, the third time, it's like you can definitely see that it's a mannequin, but it looks really good. So that was fantastic. The gravel pit scene, I love Satisfaction by the Stones playing. That's awesome.
That was like half the budget for the film was just getting
possibly
the rights to this song.
Could very well have been. And I do like the scene at the end. I think there's like some of the Arnold that I really appreciate. The Arnold and Darren McGavin scene at the end where Arnold is coaching him. You don't have to walk, but you have to try like hell. That's great. I think that's the Arnold that I know, just from Arnold being Arnold. And I love that. So I see some of the Arnold Schwarzenegger, the actual dude in there. And I wondered if he would have sort of pushed for things like that to be included, like the comments about healthy eating and, the coaching and believing yourself. I wonder if that is actually Arnold asserting himself and saying, well, can't we do it like this? And just put in that type of message in there. I like to think that that's Arnold coming out. But number one, the best moment in here is the chemical plant explosion. This is an absolutely fantastic pyrotechnic. Like it's so huge. I don't know. I didn't run back and watch it a second time. I should have, but it seems like just an amazing kick-ass huge explosion. I don't know. Maybe it's models, but man, looks fantastic. So that's my
with like a very tiny model of a guy on a bike in front of it. Because there's this, I think there's a stuntman just like trying to run away from
it. Yeah. But there's a shot where the car gets sort of encompassed by the flame as well. So I sort of wonder, is that an insert of a smaller blast? I don't know, but it looks great, I got to say.
I wouldn't be surprised if they just
I think they just blew up the different cameras running. Yeah, that's my belief too. But anyway, it's great. All right, bottom threes.
Oh, I've got what I call the country needle drop, which is the opening car chase when he's chasing the impersonating an officer. You know, just when he's chasing this guy in the Jeep and this music, the like hard country music's blaring in the background. Like, why?
Yeah.
And then just, there's a fun little moment in there because he just outsmarts the guy on the bike, lays down some petrol and just like fires up a cigar and just like just lights it up just in time for him to go, bah! It's just, but you know, like the country music, wow. Arnie likes to sit in clothes shops. That bothers me. But this is kind of like when he just sits like a robot. He goes like, I like sitting here. I've got Arnie physiotherapist. Come on. Can do it.
I like that.
And the worst moment is the fact when they do give him these lines and he doesn't know how to speak. And this is just like, this is his kryptonite, isn't it? Like, don't give, it's like you can't give Scottish people certain words to give in succession, like purple something or whatever, because they will not be able to say them. So he can't give Arnold Schwarzenegger three words in succession that start with a letter M. You know.
He molested, murdered, and mutilated her.
Go again.
He molested, murdered, and mutilated her.
He molested, murdered, and mutilated her.
He molested, murdered, and mutilated the words.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And just, what did... what he could have said was just, this woman was raped and killed. Way easier to say. She molested, murdered, and mutilated her.
He molested, murdered, and mutilated her.
Just take it in.
He molested, murdered, and mutilated her.
Oh my. That's great.
Kind of where I am.
Is that your three?
Yeah.
Okay.
Almost four.
All right. Thank you for mentioning the country music, because I forgot to write that down.
It's kind of like Smokey and the Bandit on crack. It's like Smokey and the Bandit, but you just, instead of Burt Reynolds, just put Arnold in a Jeep.
That is, you know what? That's a total Burt Reynolds opening. Thank you. So we were talking about Burt Reynolds. You've got the car. You've got the backwoods. You've got the country music. That's White Lightning or something. Yep. Perfect.
You know what he did with Burt Reynolds' movie?
He molested, murdered, and mutilated her.
Okay. What have I got here? Okay. So the scene you mentioned with Arnold clothes shopping and just sitting there like a robot. So right after that, what I had is what I think is sort of ridiculous. The henchmen that attacked him in the alley like two nights before, they just happened to be walking by, and one of them is like, has an ice cream, or two of them have ice cream. Such an 80s thing.
It's a small place.
Hey, look. is that him? Yes. And of course he's going to be at the mall because it's the 80s. So there's that. Okay. In one moment, so in Roca's office, he's got this office, and I think this is just a gaffe. It's got to be. The walls are incredibly low, so when you're facing the desk, everything looks normal. It's a normal set. But when the camera flips 180 and you see Arnold standing at the door and Robert Davi is standing there as well, it's a long shot. And you see Arnold, the door, and about 1 foot above the door, and then the set stops, and you can see, like, the sound stage, like the warehouse in behind is like, and it's like, oh my God, really? This is just a weird sloppiness.
I just didn't notice this at all.
Because I'm looking at this, I was like, that's the wall just stops.
Oh, you got then, one each. You didn't notice how the guy was fucking a llama.
The llama bestiality is probably a bigger one to miss. I don't know. Maybe I should have been happy I missed that.
I totally forgot that the set ended. Like, I didn't even notice because it was so
just stop. It looks like black, but no, you look, it's not black. It's the warehouse. It's the soundstage that they're in. Anyway, I just thought that was really bizarrely
mesmerized with Arnold.
Sloppy. And another one. So when Arnold meets McGavin for the first time, he gets the call and come meet me. So the next day he scoots over to this meeting place and Arnold pulls into a parallel parking spot like an absolute donkey. He just, it's a parallel spot, but it might as well be angled parking because he just sort of pulls in and then he's,
because he pulls the ass in front of the cars, right?
Yes, but he didn't try in.
No.
He should have reversed in, or even if he drives in, if there's oodles of room and you can do it, you know, he just pulled in. There's no 2 or 3 point turns here to center up the vehicle. No, he's angle parking and the rear end of the car is sticking out into the traffic.
Look, there's no good way of parallel parking driving forward because you'd have to mount the pavement. It's unorthodox. It's not good. Should have
driver's license
taken away. Reversing all the way.
I do agree. If you have an empty spot in front of you, you can take that spot and then center up when you back up. But you need
I still reverse. It's very easy. You can just do it more cavalier because you have all that space in front of you, so you can just, you know, align that much better. But it's still
we live in a world now, to be perfectly honest, that with the rear view camera, I feel that I'm just a master at parallel parking. So I gotta say,
oh yeah, I mean the satisfaction when you actually don't use a camera or anything, just like if you just do it on the like a glove and it in a very sort of nice and snugly sort of space without a single correction, so it just like reverse, straighten, done. So two moves
done. Totally and agree,
like I deserve like a Mars bar or something,
right? And our man Arnold, who we're honoring all month with films of his, he fails that test on this one, I got to say.
Absolutely.
All right.
Donkey.
So that's Raw Deal. Raw Deal is streaming in Canada on Crave. I think in the UK, you can get a hold of it. Studio Canal's streaming service. Is that correct? You have it, do you? Because you watch some physical media. I think it's on Studio Canal. Blu-ray.
Let me just double check. So, I have a feeling it may be on like Amazon Prime. Let me just quickly double check.
I think Studio Canal. Because I looked up earlier. Studio
Canal only?
I don't necessarily know.
Oh, it's also on ITVX.
Okay.
So if you have ITVX, you can watch it.
Perfect. And if you're in the US, it's on Tubi in the US, but not Canada. That's one of the few differences I've noticed between Tubi US and Tubi Canada. It's also on Pluto TV in the States. However, yeah, it's on DVD and Blu-ray. It's widely available. And there's a new 4K, from what I understand, as well.
That's the Studio Canal restaurant. But hold on. Let me just, okay. I'll just show you.
Because they gave him a raw deal. But the Studio Canal didn't give me a raw deal. Look at that. Ta-da.
Show off that case. That is brilliant for a strictly audio medium. Fantastic.
Exactly. and cool. The back says,
that'd be the way to watch
4K
it.
Restoration.
Awesome. All right.
Anyway,
that's where the film is. Jakob, where are you in the world and your stuff?
You know, when we were doing the Conan episode, I said, like, I'm on Twitter, or X, formerly known as Twitter, but I decided, like, I removed Twitter from my phone. I removed all social media from my phone just for help, for just mental health reasons. So I interact with Twitter at best once a day, maybe,
okay, yeah,
if at all. So, because I feel like, you know, I think I feel healthier not having the urge to scroll through other people's toxic bullshit and just arguing about shit that doesn't matter. So, for all I care, I'm not really on Twitter, but, you know, like, if you want to just look at stuff, at Talk About Film is where I am, so, you know. And then flashonfilm.com is pretty much the only sort of, like, internet outlet that I'm just kind of doing stuff with. And then, you know, like, I interact with Twitter when I have to put stuff on for the show. But, you know, like, other than that, just kind of flashonfilm.com, or just send me an email or something. Like, yeah. I'm just now, like, I feel like such a boomer. Send me a letter.
Yeah. Yeah. Drop it in the post. I hear you on Twitter. Twitter can sort of be just sort of a negative spot at times. I'm usually just there once or twice a day, and I don't scroll too far, because it's not that I get sucked into too much negativity. I just find I don't care about any of these sort of random little nuggets of people's psyche that are being dropped. Like, I'm not getting a substantial piece of them. And so, yeah. But
like 95% of what I've seen is always like, what do you think of this film? What, win or lose, WRL? I'm just like, it's all like baiting. These people just fishing for dopamine hits. I'm like, this is pathetic. You people need to just sit down. I'm just saying, like, and I'm participating in this, and I don't like the fact that I do. So I just, you know what? All I will do now is I don't want to close this account, because there are these relationships I have with people. Like, now I would probably lose any sort of touch I would have with, like, people like Jackson or Nick or whoever, right? So, or Jack. It would be very difficult, because, like, these people, or Sarah or whoever, right? So it's like, yeah, so it will feel kind of just weird, like, deleting this app. But, you know, like, I removed it from my phone, and I just, all I care about is now, in terms of, like, my free time, is just watch something and just think of something to write. And just, like, if someone wants to read, like, a 1200 words on how Sound of Freedom proves that, you know, like, left-leaning media is what evangelical right used to be in the 90s, when they really tried to convince me that if you listen to Led Zeppelin backwards, you're going to summon the devil. Then you go ahead. You go and read that.
Everyone should check out Jakob's stuff. I'm a few essays behind, but I love reading your stuff, and I'll say that. So, boom. Cool. You can find me on X. You know, I don't post too much, but I'm there. You can reach out to me, contact me that way if you like. I'm on Letterboxd at Bratch7.
Oh, right, yes.
And did you drop your Letterboxd?
No, I didn't. Okay, so Bratch7 and Jakub Flash on Letterboxd. These are the two accounts to follow. That's the social media I didn't delete.
There you go. And you'll find me on clapperltd.co.uk. And you will find me on my Facebook group, Island Film Geeks. And September is one of the months when I'm actually sort of active with it. There's a daily trivia that's going on there, movie trivia. So that's sort of fun. So check that out. Check out our website, www.uncutgemspodcast.com. You will find out all about us there. You will find all of our stuff there. Next week, meet us back here because Jakob's birthday month continues. Our Arnold film sweepstakes continue. We'll be talking about The Running Man. Have a great week. We'll be back.